Chuck, is there any time for a vote?
May I reserve 3 minutes, Chair?
Sure.
May I please report, my name is Josh Graff. I'm here today on behalf of Jamal Dominic Green. And assignments of error 2 and 3 are kind of interchangeable. The trial court, in this case, this was a jury trial, initially involving aggravated maiming, shooting a firearm in public, and use of a firearm. Green proffered several jury instructions at that stage of the trial regarding self-defense and a right-to-arm theory. The trial court denied those instructions, stating that Mr. Green had put on no evidence. And the trial court was very clear that Mr. Green bore the burden of persuasion in order to get those jury instructions in.
Assuming, though, that it could be done just from the commonwealth's evidence, where is the evidence that supports those two instructions?
It occurs on, I would submit, roundabout Appendix 85 through 87, really the totality of the video, which shows that the club owner, Mr. Romini, in this case, testified at length, both on the video and on his observations from the video, that a gentleman, an unknown gentleman, got into a fight with a female patron of his establishment.
Which turned out to be the two individuals in the truck from which the victim was speaking with when the shooting happened.
Right, and we know from Mr. Romini's testimony that it appeared to be that the gentleman who got into the truck was angry that his female companion was speaking with Mr. Green. The individual went to his truck, and then Mr. Romini testified that Mr. Green turned around with a weapon. Before Mr. Green was able to shoot the weapon, Mr. Green was shot. We know Mr. Green was shot.
The video was also shot, correct?
Yes, sir. The video was shown, and the video does not capture the truck. And so it may well be that the jury would have decided Mr. Green was the initial aggressor, but
you can't submit the jury instructions based on speculation. Your whole basis of your jury instruction argument is that somebody else fired first, and he shot in self-defense, right?
Well, I strongly disagree. That's speculative because Mr. Romini said on his direct testimony that Mr. Green was shot first. I mean, that...
Well, tell me if I'm wrong on this. According to the appellant, it simply cannot be determined from the available evidence whether appellant fired first or fired only after he was fired upon. He then went on to say that the surveillance footage did not show what was happening at the moment appellant fired his weapon, whether appellant was shot prior to the alleged discharge of the firearm. So, based on his own testimony, he doesn't know who shot first.
And that makes it a factual jury question. And there was more than a scintilla to suggest. And we have to back up a little bit. Inside the club, this unknown gentleman got into a fight with a female. Words were exchanged. He undoubtedly was in an agitated state. We know that from the record. They go out to a vehicle. He undoubtedly had a gun. We know that from the record. We know Mr. Green was shot. That's not in dispute. And we know the gentleman in the truck drove away, which certainly is consciousness of some sort of wrongdoing. And that's obviously an inference that could be drawn from the testimony that Mr. Green went to his truck and gathered a weapon. That doesn't. Green, I apologize. Mr. Green went to his truck and got a weapon.
That was before any shots were fired, right?
It was before any shots were fired, but the question of self-defense is at the moment that the shots were fired, was Mr. Green entitled to fire that weapon?
That's.
So that might well have been a factor in a possession of firearm by a violent felon, which Mr. Green also had at one point.
Who testified that somebody else fired
the shot? Mr. Rohini on page 80, if my memory serves incorrectly, 86 of the appendix, or 87 of the appendix. And so And then that was followed up on a number of times. But the question is whether there's more than a scintilla of evidence from what was shown and testified to in front of the jury to say Mr. Green could have fired that weapon in self-defense. And this was a case where we had surveillance cameras.
I think the problem, for at least for me, is that self-defense is an affirmative defense. And the law is pretty clear that the burden of persuasion to establish self-defense, at least to the extent that a reasonable doubt exists, is on your client, essentially. And the only evidence you point to here is that your client was shot. And I guess the question for me is, does that establish more than a scintilla of evidence to support an affirmative defense? I mean, in other words, does that satisfy your burden of persuasion, at least to the extent that a jury instruction should be given, when obviously there's more to self-defense than just being shot?
Well,
and so, you know, the fact that you happen to be shot does not, ipso facto, it seems to me, establish anything other than that fact, which, you know, isn't necessarily going to justify a self-defense instruction without more.
Well, that's absolutely not what Mr. Green is saying or what I'm saying in the brief. Again, the...
He didn't testify, did he?
He did not testify.
So,
he didn't need to testify.
He's not saying anything that matters to us in terms of... I mean, had he testified and said, I shot in self-defense, we'd have a different conversation right now. You know,
well, the trial...
What happened here.
The trial court was very clear that it denied the instructions because Mr. Green did not testify or put on any evidence. The trial court said that. That's not the correct
standard.
He's
not required to put on evidence. There's no question about that. But he is required to carry his burden of persuasion.
Can do that on other witnesses.
And it was by the Commonwealth's witnesses in this case. The Commonwealth's witnesses established more than a scintilla of evidence. It may not...
What did they establish beyond that your client was shot? That's what I would like to know.
That the unknown gentleman undoubtedly had a gun. He was
the SUV guy.
SUV gentleman had a gun. He was inside of the club. He got mad at his female companion for speaking with Mr. Green. A reasonable inference from that evidence is that he's mad at Mr. Green as being the male that his female companion was speaking with. He went to his truck. He appeared to know that Mr. Green, when he saw Mr. Green and was speaking with Mr. Griffin, the victim in this case, he yelled, get down, and then Mr. Romini testified that Mr. Green was hit by a bullet before Mr. Green was able to fire the weapon. So that is more... Now, the jury may not have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that was self-defense, but...
Actually, that's enough for the instruction. You might be right. I'll think about that, but let me ask you about another one of your songs there before you run out of time, and that's the one that relates to the... I guess it'd be the brandishing charge. I'm sorry, discharge of a firearm. 280E, your argument with respect to 18280E, which it's an interesting argument. I don't think it's ever been litigated before, but 280E simply says nothing in the statute shall preclude the Commonwealth from electing to prosecute under any other applicable provision of law instead of this section. Now, I gather from your brief that your basic premise there is that because the General Assembly used the word instead there, that means that their Commonwealth is required to elect elect which charge they want to prosecute, this one or a other applicable provision of law. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. My argument is not nearly as far-reaching or outrageous as the Commonwealth would have you believe in their brief. The General Assembly isn't presumed to choose its words with care. It put the word instead. We have to presume it meant something.
What are the limits of that would be, Mike? Let's assume that that's correct. Does that mean if you charge this particular either class 4 felony or class 1 misdemeanor, I guess depending on whether someone's injured or not, that you can't charge anything else, or unless you can't convict of anything else?
But That is what it means, and there's a logical reason if we stop and think about it. So we start with the meaning of the word instead, which is a substitute or replacement for
also
something.
So you have to look at the word elect.
Right, so elect between 18280 or 18251 or 51.2, whatever the case may be. But in this case, we presume that they put paragraph E in there, they meaning the General Assembly.
Well, we can make that. Let me cut it. Mr. Anderson, I'm sure, is going to address this, and he may well address the same thing I'm about to ask you about. But it seems to me that if the choice is the Commonwealth's, I mean, your argument is that it should have been struck. It was part of your motion to strike. And first of all, a motion to strike, in context, is an allegation that the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law. This provision doesn't address sufficiency of the evidence. It simply says, and I don't think it prohibits the Commonwealth from charging whatever they want to charge. If we accept your argument, at best what it does is it requires the Commonwealth to make an election between which charge they want to go forward with. And that election was not made until, it certainly wasn't made until it was raised by you, I guess, in the motion to strike. But at that point, the evidence has been presented, and it seems to me that number one, is it appropriate to make this as part of a motion to strike, because that's what you asked for, because the Commonwealth could easily have said, no, we're going to dump this one and go with the other one, you know, at that point. But your argument was that, you know, everything needed to be struck for various reasons, including this particular code section.
Well, that...
And why isn't this an attack on the indictment?
Yeah.
Well, because the Commonwealth may well have said at the end of the evidence, and I'd draw the analogy to a DUI and reckless driving where they charge both, not quite knowing on which direction the evidence is going to go. The Commonwealth could well have said...
Except that they can't proceed on both of those charges. They have to elect at the beginning or the outset of the charge.
The motion was made at a time where the trial court could have fixed the issue.
And I think their question is in terms of the election of the motion to strike.
I think you have a couple of legal procedural problems here. One is, you know, was a motion to strike the appropriate vehicle for you to challenge this, since a motion to strike is a challenge to the evidence? And the General Assembly hasn't said, you know, anything about sufficiency of the evidence here. It's just, if we accept your argument, the best the General Assembly has said here is the Commonwealth has to make an election. If they can charge all of these things, but they have to make an election at some point before trial as to which one they're going to go forward with. You waited until the middle of trial to assert anything about it. I think one issue is if that's an attack on the indictment, that comes too late because the Code of Virginia specifically says you have to deal with issues of sufficiency of the indictment issues, you know, pre-trial. But the other issue, though, is a void versus voidable situation where, yeah, you could have made that motion pre-trial, but it's now, you know, too late. It's, you know, it's merely avoidable, and you've waited too long to do it.
Well, I strongly disagree with that because, again, in the hypothetical where, let's say, a DUI and reckless driving does go forward for whatever reason, maybe the defense attorney should have addressed that before the trial starts, the trial court still had the opportunity to fix it. A timely argument was made before Mr. Green was convicted of that charge. The argument was presented in its totality that says, the statute says you have to choose one or the other. There's sufficient evidence to show an aggravated...
You have to choose. They indicted them for both this offense and the felony. What point do you have to challenge the election?
Well, certainly by the motion to strike stage. If it had been past that stage, it certainly would.
What does the word applicable mean in the statute? We talk about the word instead, but what does the word applicable mean?
Where the facts of the case would apply to some other statute. In this case, they undoubtedly apply to aggravated...
Well, let me suggest to you an alternate interpretation of the word applicable. It's also consistent with the statute. This statute is either a Class 1 misdemeanor or a Class 4 felony. Now, if it's a Class 1 misdemeanor, the code also gives local counties and cities the authority to criminalize the same conduct by ordinance. Why isn't that an applicable? Why isn't that what the General Assembly means by applicable provision of the law, where that has been done by a locality? In other words, the Commonwealth has to elect between, assuming it's a Class 1 misdemeanor, which is the only time this would ever apply, it would mean, applicable would mean as between a county or city ordinance and this particular statute.
Because we read 280 as a whole, we don't pick out isolated fragments, and subsection B talks about being on the premises of a school, subsection C talks about being within 1,000 feet of a school, and so no local ordinance would apply to subsections B and C of the statute. So in reading the whole statute as a whole, it's the quintessential case if someone fires a gun in the air out in the street and accidentally hits someone miles away. that, you know, may be manslaughter, you may not be able to prove that. It captures those circumstances where firearms are discharged in public, which we want to criminalize, obviously, that don't fall into any other case.
I think you need more than a bubble, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes in the bubble.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, take this the issue first that counsel initially broached about the instructions. I actually think that it is simpler in the Commonwealth's favor than the argument might suggest. Counsel never actually discusses the language in his proposed instructions, but when you consider them versus evidence that's absolutely incontrovertible in this case, the conclusion is inescapable. He was not entitled to any of these instructions. We know, and I think counsel in his rebuttal would agree that all of what I'm about to say is not in dispute. There was an argument in this club involving the man who ended up going to the SUV and this woman who we say was his girlfriend and a second man that was identified as the defendant. The SUV man, for lack of a more graceful term, appears angry at his girlfriend and basically yanks her, goes out to his SUV, which is parked outside. The evidence plainly shows that they get in the car and he turns the lights on, I presume the engine as well, and there's every reason to think he's about to drive off. The defendant does not stay inside the club. If he did, there is not the slightest indication that anything ever would have happened at that club.
The defendant stayed inside the club or the car, did you say?
If the defendant had stayed in the club when the SUV man went outside and got in the car and turned on the parking lots, the parking lights, if the defendant stayed in the club, end of story, at least for that night. There had been nothing that could have happened or would have happened outside. The defendant chose, however, not to stay within the club.
He's not required to stay in the club.
No, he isn't.
He wasn't an aggressor in the altercation in the bar.
But it ties in with some of the key language. All I'm saying is if he'd stayed in there, there never would have been anything that happened. He chose not to, and instead he goes outside. According to the plain testimony of the club owner, he goes to, and there's no indication, because he'd been in the club, no indication anyone had seen him with a gun within the club, and he then goes to his car, retrieves something, brings it back, according to the club owner, appeared to be hiding it, and then while the victim, Mr. soon-to-be victim, Mr. Griffin, is talking with the SUV driver, and they played pool. There's no indication that they had any particular prior relationship of any sort. And he's basically saying, why don't you come on? Griffin is saying to the SUV man, why don't you come back in? We'll play some pool. Having a pretty innocuous conversation. And so under those circumstances, the defendant goes outside, goes to his car, retrieves something, appears to be hiding it, and walks back towards them, and then the club owner saw, as he sort of turns around, sees him with the gun. And there's no dispute about the fact that the defendant...
So him is the appellant?
Yes, the appellant, Mr. Green, comes back from having retrieved something in his car, approaches in the direction where Griffin, the victim, is talking with the SUV man in his car with the lights on, ready to drive away. And the defendant, Green, turns around, the owner sees him with the gun. I submit that those facts alone disentitle him, and then there's a shootout shortly thereafter. I submit that those facts alone, uncontroverted facts, show this defendant was not properly entitled to any of these instructions.
Look at me. Let me ask you a question. If following the facts to your point, they would not be, but what the appellant's indicating is that Mr. Rahini indicates that Mr. Green was shot before he could shoot.
Your Honor, my point is those arguments by themselves render these instructions inapplicable irrespective of what happened thereafter. If you look at instruction V, Appendix 28. If you believe that the defendant was without fault in provoking or bringing on the difficulty, again, he could have stayed in the club. He didn't do it. He gets a gun and walks towards him. There's no way that can...
But that's not, I think, with all due respect, Mr. Anderson, I think the evidence, if I understand your colleague's argument, it boils down to he was not required to stay in the club. He's perfectly entitled to go to his car. He's actually perfectly entitled to arm himself if that's what he wants to do, Second Amendment and all that good stuff. It's more than a scintilla of evidence to warrant at least the jury considering whether he acted in self-defense, just based on the fact of the motive of anger against Mr. Green that was established by the altercation in the bar, and the fact that he was shot. And therefore, you know, the jury should be entitled to consider all these other things you're talking about, whether there was a duty to retreat, whether there was, you know, whether he did have a role in bringing on the altercation, and so forth. All of that would be the ultimate fact-finding process, but it's a different standard from whether there's more than a scintilla of evidence that justifies the instruction.
Well, I'm going to start to move over to put it more in terms of how I briefed it, but again, the fact that you literally have the right to do this, that it's not illegal to do that, begs the question of whether if you do three or four things under certain circumstances, that renders you at least partly at fault in terms of what happened.
Which is a jury question.
No, I think it has to do with...
The court would have to rule as a matter of law that you're at fault in doing all these perfectly legal things in order to get to the point you want us to get to.
I submit that if the evidence is uncontradicted, that the defendant did the various things he did here, that the court, it's an abuse of discretion ruling, that the court could properly conclude that he was certainly played some fault in terms of what happened at that shootout. Now, my brief didn't limit it to that, although I still think if you look at the language, if he'd stayed in there, then he, by definition, would not have had a reasonable fear of imminent death. These people are about to pull off. But again, to put it more in terms of how I briefed it, Griffin, the victim, testified he's having what appears by all indications to be an innocuous conversation with the man in the SUV. And Griffin didn't really know the man in the SUV, although he played pool with him that night. But there's no indication that they were some kind of co-conspirators of some sort. He was just simply saying, why don't you come back in and play pool? And at that point, and this is at pages 52 and 53 of the appendix, Griffin, the victim, says quite plainly that Griffin, was shot before the man in the SUV ever pulled out a gun. That is clear cut. As for the club owner, the first reference to anyone having a gun that they displayed, according to what he saw, either with his own eyes or watching the surveillance footage, was the defendant retrieving what by all rights must have been a gun, coming back towards that area, turning around, he sees the gun. So, under those circumstances, even if he was not literally the first one to fire the gun, he certainly is disentitled from any of these instructions. He surely... If he displayed the gun first, even if he didn't fire it first, he surely cannot say he was without fault in provoking or bringing on the difficulty, which was B.
In terms of the self-defense instruction, who was he supposed to have shot at in self-defense?
Who, the defendant?
Yeah.
Presumably, he, because of the earlier disagreement inside the club with the SUV man, presumably he had bore some animus towards that SUV man sitting in his car, again with the lights on, about to leave. Presumably he meant to shoot at him. He didn't. I mean, as unfortunately often happens, the innocent third party, in this case Griffin, who was standing near the SUV man, was the one shot. There's no indication that Griffin was ever the intended victim of the shot, because there's nothing in the record to indicate any reason to have tried to shoot him. He just happened to be, unfortunately, right, wrong place, wrong time. But he was, again, it sounds like the SUV man sitting in his car about to drive away, it sounds like Griffin is sort of leaning over and chatting, saying, why don't you come back and play some pool? And he was close enough to him that unfortunately he got shot.
We're talking about transfer in 10, I guess. In 10, mm-hmm.
Right. I think that would be a pretty straightforward example of transferred intent. I think way back in the midst of history, I had a case in the Supreme Court with a transferred, in, I think from Portsmouth. I think the, pretty sure the defendant's name was Riddick. And I, it was a pretty straightforward example of transferred intent where innocent third party was the one that was shot. And so this to me would be.
How you use your time, but I would like you to address the statutory.
Oh, sure. This is, and the court has identified some procedural difficulties for the defendant raising this issue. I would also point out the following, that is statutory construction 101, that a statute should be construed to avoid an unreasonable or absurd result. The defendant in this case, and it's not very clear at all why the third charge of aggravated malicious wounding resulted in acquittal, but the use of the firearm in the course of that resulted in a conviction, but we don't have an inconsistent verdict issue on appeal. But there's no question that the defendant's position is that under section 18.280, that if the defendant was prosecuted for violating that provision, this public discharge, and in this case where someone's hurt, that that would have foreclosed at the outset another charge for, in this case, aggravated malicious wounding. If you look at page 8 of his brief, he says, put simply, paragraph E of Virginia Code section 18.2-280 does not allow the Commonwealth to charge a defendant with discharging a firearm in public causing bodily injury and another crime involving an injury that occurred from the same gunshot. So in other words, the other crime is not just simply a second firearm-related count. It's a crime that involves injury. In this case, aggravated malicious wounding. That seems to me an extraordinary outcome, one that the General Assembly surely could not have contemplated.
Mr. Henshaw, do you want to speak more specifically, though, to his comment or argument in terms of Section E, in terms of right. the word instead?
Well, and that's clearly his best argument, and I think, frankly, it's somewhat problematical. I would simply submit, for various reasons, that at worst it's ambiguous, partly because of...
Are we supposed to ignore it?
No, you're not supposed to ignore it, but...
Well, what did the General Assembly mean when they said it?
Well, I think that what they meant to say was that you can prosecute for all these various things, and there are reasons to conclude that.
Well, choosing one of several options, right?
Excuse me?
Elect means choosing among several options.
Right.
Instead means one in place of the other.
Right. But I think even, I think I've even cited this on brief, that you take the literal words of the statute and they're not always invariably controlling. And I think this is one of those, Polony, this case I argued recently in this court, so animal abuse case. We must determine the General Assembly's intent from the words appearing in the statute unless a literal construction of the statute would yield an absurd result. I would say three or four things as to this overall point. One, and this is not a double jeopardy case, and counsel said quite correctly it's not. It's purely statutory construction. But the fact is, several cases of the Supreme Court of Virginia have made clear that you can have multiple punishments for the same act. Section 19.2-294, which is a statutory provision, has made clear you can have multiple punishments as long as it's within one prosecution, not separate trials. There have been multiple cases that I've cited in which the defendant was convicted under 18.2-280 as well as other offenses apparently never the slightest issue raised in any of them, which I think is somewhat indicative of the fact that it's not regarded as a problem. Further, and this gets to the statutory construction.
There's zero case law on
this particular point. That's true. I mean, I'm sort of in effect relying from a negative implication, which I will say flat out. That's what I'm doing.
You know, about the refart up in the statute.
Well, some people are not as creative as opposing counsel, which is a compliment to him. But just to get through, make one more sentence, which is, and this is, again, in terms of the General Assembly, what it intended and what is a reasonable versus unreasonable result. The three statutes here, the one and only statute that involved a crime in a public setting was 18.2-280. You obviously could have an aggravated malicious wounding in the den of a home. You could have a use of a firearm in the commission of a felony in a kitchen or den. 18.2-280 here, and in many, many instances, is the only one that deals with the societal interest of trying to make public settings as safe as possible. There's no reason whatever to think that the General Assembly, where there are discrete societal interests being protected, that it meant to put the Commonwealth in the kind of either-or choice that opposing counsel's construction would necessarily bring about. So I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
I appreciate the extra time, Your Honor. Just briefly dealing with the procedural issue with 18.2-280. In this case, the evidence as came out as was dealt with in the initial motion to strike, dealt with all the evidence that was presented at trial. The trial court denied the motion to strike the aggravated maiming and use of a firearm in the aggravated maiming indictments. I would submit to the court in response, Judge Humphreys, to your question a bit ago, if Mr. Green or IAS's attorney had realized after the trial within an appropriate period of time that this was an issue and to file a motion to set it aside, I would submit that it would have been timely at that time. It was not an issue with the indictment. Again, no differently than 19.2 prohibiting someone from...
They were indicted under discharging a firearm and indicted for aggravated malicious wounding, right? Wouldn't that have keyed in to the fact that the statute doesn't allow that?
But the question I would submit to the court is that after all the evidence came in, the issue was presented to the trial court at a time where the trial court could have corrected the error, just as if due to the negligence of a defense attorney or prosecutor or both, they allowed a reckless driving and a DUI to proceed all the way through trial, and that person was found guilty of both, and the defense attorney was like, oh, that can't happen, and filed an appropriate post-trial motion in a timely manner to correct that mistake. That would still be a timely way to get it before the trial court so that error could be corrected before it got to this stage. And so the argument was presented to the trial court at a time, and perhaps trial counsel certainly could always do a better job, but it was at least presented at a time where the trial court could have addressed the issue and corrected it. And with regard to assignments of error B and C, or 2 and 3, once you read all of the record as a whole, the analysis previously gone through was correct. Mr. Green was acting at least lawfully for purposes of this trial. Every step of the way, he was entitled to leave the club, he was entitled to go to his car, he was entitled to get a gun, and then there was testimony about what happened after that time. We know the gentleman in the truck ran away without cooperating with the police and was angry inside of the club. The question is whether that amounts to more than a scintilla of evidence to present the question to the jury. The jury may have decided Mr. Green was partially at fault, or they may have just completely disagreed that it was self-defense and convicted him anyway. But they were entitled to make that choice. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to come down to recount, and the court will be adjourned.